Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined, as always, by my colleague Stuart Mandel. Stu, we got some ugly news that has surfaced in the police blotter that, as we tape this on Tuesday, that came up yesterday. Stu, it's rare that we talk about Big 12 doormat Kansas football, but Les Miles has brought some attention there, and his most talented player, Puka Williams, who's been in trouble, has furthered that spotlight. What do we make of this?
Puka Williams was the freshman standout running back for the Jayhawks last season. Pretty much he's got to be the first guy to come through there in many years who was worth tuning in for. Like, oh my gosh, Kansas has this really great player. Well, he was arrested earlier this offseason. It made its way through the courts, and I think he was put into a diversion program. But the facts of the case are pretty clear. A woman accused him of punching her in the stomach and grabbing her throat, and it turned out that he admitted to it over a text message, and police officers found bruises on the woman. So while there's no video, that obviously when there's a video, it takes these cases to suddenly everybody becomes aware of them. But the facts are pretty clear. So Les Miles has delivered his verdict. He will miss the first game against an FCS team. And, you know, there's always at least one of these a year where there's outrage that you're not going to punish the guy more than that. And there's really nothing that can be done about it. The NCAA doesn't have any sort of oversight of how it's up to the schools themselves how they punish these kids. But I can't say I'm surprised, because it's kind of how Les Miles handled violent acts by his players at LSU.
Yeah, I thought one of the voices in this that is one of the leading voices when it comes to this issue, and that sexual violence, is Brenda Tracy. And she had commented, "Coaches, when dealing with your players and issues of sexual assault and domestic violence, a one-game suspension is never appropriate. I don't care what else is going on. One-game suspension only sends one message. The victim doesn't matter, and what your player did isn't a big deal." I agree with that. The one-game suspension, now, I don't know what would be fitting or appropriate. There are some people who are going to go, well, he sat out and complied with all the issues KU had set out when it went through the system, and 7 months. You know, look, the off season is the off season. At some point, you wonder about where is the accountability on this. You know, I feel like if you're a KU fan, you're probably going, well, he's going to, you know, he's taking away football for the off season, and he's going to miss a game. And I think unless it's a player associated with your team, it's rare that people are like going to say, no, that's not going to say that's, yeah, that's fitting in this day and age. Now, if he sat out four games, would you think that would be a more apt punishment? Three games?
Yeah. I mean, that's where it's kind of a no-win situation. Cause either in these situations, either the guy gets kicked off the team, or it's a very light punishment like this, because there's no guideline, right, that says, well, based on these particular circumstances, you should suspend them for six games or four games or whatever it may be. But I do agree with Brenda that one game, because, you know, when we get to the start of this season, there will be a bunch of guys who sit out the first game of the season for far more minor transgressions than that. That one game suspension is kind of the token thing you hand out for guy, you know, didn't show up for a meeting, or, you know, some things like that. It kind of trivializes a very violent act. But again, I was very critical of the hiring of Les Miles. It wasn't for this reason, but another knock against him. We talked about this a few years ago with Steve Spurrier. When somebody is charismatic and full of jokes and can kind of charm the media, I feel like they don't get as much criticism over some things as maybe others would. You know, at LSU, he had Jeremy Hill, who was arrested for a violent crime, who I don't believe ever missed a game. Jordan Jefferson got reinstated very quickly. That was kind of his MO there. He just didn't care. He just wants to win. So I wasn't expecting him to kick him off the team by any means, but I do think one game sends the wrong message.
Well, one thing I thought of is somebody else, a colleague of mine had discussed that and talked about, well, this is what Les did at LSU. And the one thing, you know, I brought up, right or wrong, is it's 2019 now. It's not 2010. And I don't know if, you know, our expectations are that the punishments should be stricter, we should be sending more of a message. And we obviously, in this case, is the college football coaches. It goes back to this thing. We talked about this a couple months ago with, I think it was related to Dan Mullen and the issue of zero tolerance against this issue. I don't know if they know what zero tolerance really is, you know, if that's what it is. And I think, you know, one area, which I don't want to call it a gray area. I don't know how, you know, I think there is a lot of people who fall into this category who think, well, if somebody grabs somebody or punched them in the arm is different than punching a woman in the face. And it's like there's levels to this, I think, is how it's seen. What do you think of that?
I think it's impossible to have a catch-all punishment for any sort of act of violence because literally any two situations like this, right, are going to have a different set of facts. So now the NFL has tried to do it to some degree, right? And even there's a lot of inconsistency. They have been handing down stiffer punishments, but it can vary wildly from one to the next. So, you know, it's just, I don't know. I don't know if there's ever going to be a way to do this that everybody would say, yep, that's the right way to do it. That was the right, you know, that was the just punishment. I just know that one game, I mean, even if he had said two games, I still think there'd be criticism. But one game is, you know, the bare minimum. It's against an FC. It's probably the one game that Kansas is assured of winning without Puka Williams, right? They need him for all the other games.
Yeah, you would think. And look, the more these stories get talked about, I do think it is a positive in that regard. And I do think that the expectations are higher now. And I do think it's good that a lot of programs and things like the opening are bringing in Brenda Tracy and other speakers to raise awareness of domestic violence and sexual violence. I think to have that discussion, I think, is ultimately a positive thing. And I'm curious, you know, we're basically on the eve of conference media days, and Les Miles is going to be back at a podium, where, as you referenced before, he can be really charming, and he's a very unique speaker, and he's really charismatic. And I think that he is going to get asked about it, I'm sure, because it's Puka Williams. It's the most dynamic player Kansas has had in a long time. And this happened the week before this. I'm sure it's going to come up, and we really haven't heard Les talk about it. And we'll see how he explains it. And I'm guessing it's probably not going to be enough for a lot of people. And for some people, they'll just move on after it.
I'm sure he'll be asked about it, and I'm sure there'll be some stories about it. But I bet you there'll be far more Les is back in college football and charged up stories, right? Because it's conference media days. It's a happy time. Everybody's undefeated.
Yeah, and I do think there's a layers of this where it's just like, hey, you know what? The season's right around the corner. I'm not sure how much, if you were going to write a lot about Les Miles, I don't know, you probably already would have written about Les Miles. I don't think you'd be necessarily doing the Les's backstory from Texas and Big 12 media days.
Well, we take it for granted, I think, in our roles as national writers that, you know, we have the freedom to, if we wanted to do that story, we can just up and fly to Kansas at any time. A lot of the people that will be at media days are people who cover other teams in the conference. This is their first chance to see him. So, no, so I think right. That story will be written a lot.
You're right. But I do think that I suspect this story, because like I said, because it's Puka Williams, will now be attached to his Les's backstory.
That is true. By the way, we got off kind of a dark start here to the podcast, and we actually have another sad story to get to in a second. So let me just back up a second. How was your holiday weekend?
It was good. Went to a Dodger game on July 4th, it was fun to be there. Got to see my colleague Joe Davis, who calls Dodger games. It was a good experience. I know you went on vacation somewhere far, far away.
We snuck in a trip to Hawaii over 4th of July weekend, which was probably more ambitious than we should have taken on. And let me tell you something. You know, people always talk about what's the best time zone to be in for sports. And I think you and I both believe Pacific time is ideal, especially on a college football Saturday. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to make an argument right now for Hawaiian time. Ready? So Hawaii is 3 hours earlier than California. Okay, well, this came as both an advantage and a disadvantage while I was there. Advantage, the crazy night that Kawhi Leonard signed with the Clippers and Paul George as well. You know, most of America was asleep when that happened, but I got to follow it in real time. Were you still up for that?
I don't think I wasn't online at that point. No,
I just happened to get back to the room and check my phone, and I forget what I saw first. You know how when you're looking on Twitter, you're seeing the most recent first. So it was like the reactions to the original Woj bomb. You know, it took a little bit to actually, because it didn't make any sense to go back and figure out what exactly the original report was. But that was kind of funny to watch play out in real time. But then Sunday morning, to watch the U.S. women in the championship game, that required getting up at 5 in the morning, which was not ideal. However, now we were flying home that day, so I didn't get to take advantage of this, but I thought about it after the fact. If we weren't going to the airport that day, I would have had the best seats at the pool if I wanted to. I'd be the watch the game and then go be the first one there.
I'm guessing that it's not ideal to be on Hawaii time for most sporting events. It's going to be too early for a lot of stuff. Like, what time does college football kick off there?
6 a.m. for the noon Eastern games. Probably not going to be catching any of game day, I would think.
No, I wouldn't think so.
But, you know, I think you're used to getting up early to go to the beach. So, yeah, why not? No, I don't know how it would work all the time. But that's how it worked this past weekend. And by the way, how fun was the Women's World Cup Championship? It's I really enjoyed the one 4 years ago. That was probably the first one that I got really into. And I did not get to see as much of this year's tournament, but I saw that game for sure. And, God, it's fun, isn't it?
Do you become more of a soccer fan, or is this just a, you know, every few years deal?
Now it's still an every few years thing. I don't really watch much in the years in between the World Cup, men or women, though I'm more aware of it, certainly. I mean, first of all, it's been amazing to watch the transformation, and I know we're going on a bit of a tangent here, but I think back to, like, 10 years ago, you wouldn't see much of any coverage of soccer, you know, at any point, World Cup or not. And, you know, I went on ESPN.com, I think, Monday morning, and all of the headlines were about soccer from the day before, not just the women, but the men's game that they lost to Mexico. You know, you see much more mainstream coverage of Premier League and Champions League and all those things. And then, most of all, it seems like everybody I follow on Twitter does watch it. They're all tweeting about it in real time. So when I was growing up, we would play soccer and everybody would say, oh, it's going to be the sport of the future. And then that would never really come to pass, but it does feel like it's finally happening.
Well, it's definitely increased quite a bit. I know so much more involved with kids than other sports. And, you know, obviously we can get on a big tangent here.
If the men's team was actually any good, if they were, you know, they don't have to be as dominant as the women's team, but if they were actually, you know, made the World Cup and then actually advanced in it, I mean, it would be that much bigger. You know, unfortunately we don't, like, I don't feel like there's a Megan Rapinoe or an Alex Morgan that a lot of, you know, young kids grow up watching on the men's side. I mean, they watch Messi. They watch guys from other countries. But anyway, I don't really have a good way to bring this back. Well, one thing that happened over that holiday weekend, unfortunately, very sad. Jared Lorenzen, star quarterback at Kentucky, went on and played in the NFL for a little bit. Obviously, very unique, very well known as the Hefty Lefty and other great nicknames. But sadly, he passed away before he got to the age of 40. And you wrote about it that day for The Athletic.
Yeah, it's a story where he was one of these kind of, I would say, fits into the category of folk hero, a rare talent, big, big personality who was just very connected to the fan base there, especially. You know, when I thought about this, because, you know, it's somebody you'd heard about, somebody you'd watched play, but, you know, only 38 years old. And so I had reached out to Neil Brown, who is one of his former receivers and now is obviously the head coach at West Virginia. And he just raved about Jared's athleticism. He's told me a story about how they all had went on spring break and he goes, we were going to go play, you know, we'd play basketball. And, you know, most of the guys who he's talking about were really good athletes and played high school basketball. And he said Jared at like 6'4", 300 pounds was dominating those games. You know, he was just that much better than everybody else at basketball. And he also said he had the best arm talent of anybody I'd ever played with or coached or been around. And remember, he was the guy before him was the first pick in the draft, Tim Couch. So that's a big mouthful. And then I talked to Hal Mumme, who just had these remarkable stories of like Bunyan-esque kind of stories about his talent and his just kind of his persona. And everybody just seemed to love Jerry Lorenzen, and it's really sad. Gone way too soon, but he definitely has impacted a lot of people, not just people inside the state of Kentucky.
He was actually, you know, a standout in high school in Northern Kentucky, right across from Cincinnati when I was in college, but still there. And so, you know, the legend was already building then. He was obviously, you know, big time high school recruit who was staying in the state and playing for Kentucky. And, you know, and then he lived up to it more, both in terms of his performance on the field and the, you know, persona that he took on. So that was a very sad story to see. We just want to extend our condolences to his family and to obviously everybody who's a Kentucky fan or just a fan of the sport who enjoyed watching him. You were very busy while I was on vacation. You wrote that story. You also, it's Freaks Week, right? You're, as we record this, you're two installments into the annual Freaks List, which I assume is the thing you're most recognized for.
At least as a writing thing, yeah, because I've been doing it now for so long. It's not that far off 20 years now. So,
jeez, I didn't realize it went that far back.
Yeah, I think it's like 2003 or 2004. It might be 2003.
When did it first become a five-part series?
You know, there had been, wherever I've worked now, like do you remember Teddy, who used to work with at Fox Sports? You remember that name?
Yeah, yeah. I think his name came up on the podcast only a couple weeks ago.
So Teddy had some ideas how to kind of leverage the brand of that. And there were some other people we worked with who did that. And I think SI did that. And now The Athletic, you know, it's kind of grown and become something about for the combine. There's a different version of it and whatnot. But I always forget how much of a bear it is the week of, just because there's a lot of stuff that comes in where you're hearing from different coaches right before, oh, we're testing at the end of the summer, or, you know, right before camp and whatnot. And so it's just kind of, no one's on the same timetable but the reaction to it's always pretty strong. And so, that's what it is this week. And it's definitely keeping me busy this week.
Well, the cool thing is it's become a badge of honor, like being named to, you know, the Biletnikoff watch list or whatnot, being named to your Freaks List makes news. I just want you to tell people about, there are, what, tens of thousands of FBS college football players, and it's not like this list is just the star players. I mean, this can be anybody on any team. How do you even go about, you know, narrowing it down to a reasonable list of contenders?
Well, there's nothing obviously scientific. It's a lot of anecdotal stuff. Either I hear from a lot of strength coaches, hear from a lot of coaches, occasionally hear from some players, and SIDs. And so it's a lot of correspondence back with all those people, and you get your numbers. And the one thing I am pretty proud of with this is relatively early on, and this might go from the first 5 or 6 years, you'd hear from some people, and this was even before the Twitter age, where it was like, you know, I feel like the climate has gotten much snarkier, certainly in the last, you know, 5, 6 years. But people would be like, yeah, these are just inflated numbers. Well, then a lot of these guys would show up at the NFL Combine, and they would do like the exact same numbers. You know, the first guy people were really skeptical of, I remember, was Margus Hunt from SMU, who is this Estonian shot putter. And he went to the combine and did all the crazy stuff that was said in the story. You know, Saquon Barkley and Mike Gesicki from Penn State, same deal. Noah Fant from Iowa, you know, last year, same deal. You know, a lesser extent, John Kaminsky, who I had in the Kaminsky from a Division II school in West Virginia, who I had in our thing last spring for the combine, did all the same stuff. And so it's not to say everybody's 100% like that, but you look back, even the crazy stuff Rashawn Gary did at Michigan, it backed up. I think the examples are more times than not they do. So that's, you know, I think that only increases the kind of buzz that this thing gets. And, you know, I'm thankful for all the support I've gotten from, you know, especially a lot of coaches who I rely on for this intel.
Very good. Well, we encourage people to go on The Athletic and check it out this week. You can also read another big story you did, of one of the most popular stories we've had, frankly, about a very, very unique assistant coach. Is there a way for you to describe, for anybody who hasn't read it yet, for you to describe Nebraska's quarterback coach without getting too into the scientific jargon that he uses?
Well, first of all, like, Mario Verduzco is a very unique character. Like, people look at him, they see, like, he has the same round John Lemon.
He does not look like a football coach at all. I can't imagine there are many other, if any other, you know, guys you'll see on the sideline on Saturday that have his look.
No, the round John Lennon style frames. He sometimes chomps on an unlit cigar, kind of charcoal feathered back hair, smaller guy. Just, you know, I think people would say, okay, he's kind of quirky, you know, at the very least. And then you hear some of these stories, and I had met him, really kind of got to know him. Our crew did an Ohio State Nebraska game last year. The day before the game, in our production meeting, Scott Frost told a really, you know, interesting story about how when he got promoted to be the OC at Oregon and quarterback coach, he did not want to screw up Marcus Mariota. So he had flew Mario, who had worked with him at Northern Iowa, in, basically said, hey, for 2 days, I want you to put me through your drills and do everything, coach me like a quarterback. So he did, and Frost said it kind of blew his mind. But by the end of these 2 days, he goes, I threw it better than I ever had in my life. More velocity, more accurate, everything. He goes, I was 39 years old. And so when Scott Frost got to be head coach at UCF, he went and hired Mario Verduzco, who had done really well with a bunch of quarterbacks there at Northern Iowa, including a guy who holds FCS records. And so when I went to see him, you know, you walk into the office, and if there's ever like a setting you'd find a quote unquote guru in college football, this is it. You walk in and there is opera music playing from his speakers, and just, you know, he's walking around in his socks and just an interesting man. You look on the bookshelf and there's Nietzsche books and books from, you know, on religion and biomechanics and all this other stuff that you just would not expect to see from any other, you know, football coach. So he started talking, and you know, he's on the board diagramming, and there's Nietzsche quotes and Machiavelli quotes and all this other stuff. And it's pretty overwhelming, to be honest. I spent 3 hours in there with him, and then went and heard him speak at the Nebraska, you know, high school coaches clinic later that day. And he was a little different speaking to that group. There wasn't as many of those quotes. But when I got home, I had some other stories to work on, and this story was like kind of sitting, you know, in the back of my mind. And so over time, I would go back to Mario, and I must have talked to him for 12 hours on a bunch of separate occasions over the previous month to try to basically figure out what he was talking about, because a lot of the stuff wasn't just over my head. Like you, I went to college, but I'm guessing you don't know that much about what Nietzsche's about. I'm guessing you don't know anything about Richard A. Schmidt, who's one of the guys who Mario talks about the most. Who's kind
no,
of like
I mostly
Godfather.
In college just learned about the inverted pyramid and journalism 101. All that stuff would go over my head.
Yeah, and it went over my head. And even when he talked about it, you know, I could Google it, but I just didn't get how it fit together. And so what that story is really how it matters and why it's unique. And what was really fascinating was the story went up, whatever, 6 a.m., Pacific time or so. I think I tweeted it out. Within a half hour, I got a DM from a coach I don't know, who I've never met, who's an offensive coordinator in FBS football, who talked about just how much Mario had impacted him because he had seen him early on in his playing career, and said he learned more about football from Mario than just about in that short time, just about anybody. And I started hearing from more and more coaches at all levels about how fascinated they were by what Mario did. And one of the people I heard from is a strength coach who's worked in both the SEC as well as the NFL. And he raved about the story, and he said this, and this is, I'm going to tell you, you know, part of this text. The sad reality is this is how coaching should be done, but coaches like him are typically shunned in football because of their, quote, scientific approach. Other sports domains, such as rugby, downhill skiing, and golf, utilize physics and motor learning as bedrocks for coaching. Sadly, if Scott Frost didn't see this man's work up front, he'd probably still be at Northern Iowa, probably still be happy, because he's too smart for most organizations. And he goes, you just did football a big favor by writing this article. So it's fascinating.
Well, that's got
to
be a good
this.
Feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting because I never really thought about, when I wrote the story, that kind of impact or that part of it. But, you know, when you talk to people about, again, Mario will say, this isn't really me, my philosophy. This is the science. I am just listening to the science. And so it's unique. And for people who haven't checked, you know, this is one story I was like, all right, you know, I'm sure Nebraska fans will be interested in this because it's a Nebraska football coach. But I think what I kind of had an idea once it was going up, this story is going to resonate a lot more beyond just the Nebraska fan base. And that seems to be what happened from looking at the metrics of this story now.
Yeah, they're very good, to say the least. All right. Well, it's been a couple weeks. We have a lot of mailbags, a lot of emails from our listeners stored up. What do you say we get to the mailbag?
That sounds like a good plan.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. By the way, I can't even remember what caused us to tell people. Do you remember what the impetus was of me saying, if you can guess our ages, write in?
I think it probably had something to do with something I had mentioned to you, and I thought it was in your window of time, and you were like, well, I was 12 years old. I was more of a Bengals fan. I didn't follow college.
No, that was something we texted about offline. It was something we said. I think we were going down a deep rabbit hole, like the one-hit wonders, and Maurice Claret and all that. Like, I wonder how old people think we are. Well, anyway, a lot of people attempted to guess, and so at the end of this segment, we will get into that. But right now, let's start with John in Cincinnati. Wasn't that the name of an HBO show? John from Cincinnati was a. It only lasted one season, but it was one of those mysterious HBO shows.
Aren't you Stu from Cincinnati, by the way?
Yes, but I didn't get a TV show made after me, so there you go. Stu and Bruce, with most of the focus on head coaching hires, which don't typically result in a playoff appearance in year one, which coordinator hires are most likely to have a positive impact on a contending team? Full transparency, I'm a Michigan fan. I couldn't be more excited about the Josh Gattis hire. Great piece on The Athletic, by the way, Bruce. But he lists some other possibilities here. Mike Yurcich, is he the new OC or the new co-OC at Ohio State?
I think he's the new co-OC. Kevin Wilson's still there. And Ryan Day is still going to be the play caller, though.
Steve Sarkisian, the OC at Alabama. Graham Harrell at USC. Alex Grinch, the DC at Oklahoma. Kendall Briles, OC at Florida State. And Greg Madison, co-DC at Ohio State. Does one of those names stand? I guess we would start. Do any of those names do you believe in even more than Gattis? And if so, which one?
The one on there that intrigues me the most is Alex Grinch at Oklahoma. He did a phenomenal job at Washington State, where he did not have that much to work with. And he was tough for other play callers to kind of get a read on. And Oklahoma's defense has been a real dud for a long time. And I think they're good enough in other areas where they can be a playoff team, because they've been a playoff team the last few years. And we know Lincoln Riley really knows what he's doing. Those other names, you know, I think, again, and this is my mistake if I read into this question, but it's like I took this as playoff contenders, right, of which teams there. I don't think FSU is in the mix for that. As far as Greg Madison, like, I don't think the Ohio State guys necessarily fit in there, because Ryan Day's still going to be probably the play caller, and I'm sure Yurcich will help. I mean, the guy's got a crazy and deep memory and everything from what I've heard. Greg Madison has got Jeff Hafley, who I think a lot of people are going to find out is a really great hire from everything I've heard. I don't think USC is a playoff contender. So basically of this group, it comes down to Sark, and I thought Alex Grinch. And so I thought Alex Grinch because he can make a much bigger impact, just because Alabama was really good on offense, or were great on offense last year. I'm not saying Sark will make them not great, but I just think that, you know, the bar is already really high, whereas, you know, Grinch can fix something that was an issue.
So I have the same answer as you. If we're only limiting it to playoff contenders, that's tough, because, I mean, a lot of these guys are taking over teams that are already already there pretty much. How much of an impact can you have? But with Oklahoma, the defense has been just so bad the last couple of years. The fact that they even went as far as they did with that defense is incredible. So, there's a lot of room to grow there. He actually, Grinch got a little bit of took a little bit of heat inadvertently recently when a recruit committed to them and said publicly that part of the recruiting pitch to this guy was that they're really bad on defense. They don't have any NFL players. So, which comes off as him throwing his current players under the bus. Now, that's coming from the recruit. You don't know what was actually said, obviously. Also, I would imagine that's a lot of assistant coaches recruiting pitches to guys. You're trying to get them to come in and let them know that they'll have a chance to play right away. But anyway, I think, though, there's got to be more talent there, even if they're not Alabama. I mean, it's Oklahoma. There's got to be more talent there than it would appear from watching the games. So Grinch comes from a background where he worked on the other side of an air raid offense at Washington State and showed that you can have a decent defense. They're not mutually exclusive, so very interested to see what he does.
Can I throw a couple other names out since we're talking playoff contenders and just get your thoughts on them? Because I'm guessing you didn't think of the question this way, nor did I necessarily. So we talked about Josh Gattis a little bit, and obviously I wrote about him. Andy Avalos is now the defensive coordinator at Oregon. Oregon, I think, has a chance to get in the playoff this year. They should be terrific on the offensive line. Got a really talented quarterback in Justin Herbert. Jim Leavitt is out. Andy Avalos is in. Do you like the move?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough when you're replacing a guy who was already so well-respected in Leavitt, but I am interested to see the impact that he can have.
All right. And there's another one that I don't want to say this is under the radar because it's beyond that. But Jim Chaney was the offensive coordinator at Georgia, and Kirby Smart's a defensive guy. So now James Coley has moved up. What do you think of that one?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, what do you think about Jim Chaney at Tennessee?
Tennessee's not a playoff contender.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, TBD. I don't know enough about James Cole. I mean, I know him as a recruiter. I don't know as much about him to have any real hunch about what kind of play caller he will be. Do you?
I don't know. I mean, he was at Miami for a little bit in that role. He inherits a really good quarterback and obviously some terrific running backs and I think a really good offensive line, but very unproven at receiver. That one's to me a little more of a TBD on it. By the way, I thought the Jim Chaney hire for Tennessee is a terrific one. And then the other one is on the other side of the ball at Alabama, because Pete Golding takes over the official role as a defensive coordinator. So there's a few coordinators at these big schools. I guess you could put Joe Brady from LSU. He's the pass game coordinator and big impact there on their staff from just being down there. So there's a handful of other names, but I'm going to still stick with Alex Grinch just because they were so underwhelming on defense, and I think he will get that remedied to a large degree.
I'm just curious, what in your mind makes Jim Chaney a terrific OC hire for Tennessee, who, by the way, made him the highest paid offensive coordinator in the country?
I think Jim Chaney is just a really smart offensive mind. He's really experienced. I think he can be able – he worked for Kirby Smart. And Kirby Smart is also from the Nick Saban tree. I'm not saying Kirby Smart's the – just because he is the same temperament as Jeremy Pruitt. But I don't think Jim Chaney is going to be fazed by anything. And so I think he's seen a little bit of everything. And now I would feel probably even better about it if he got to bring Sam Pittman. Those are the kind of frickin' frack of things. And they've worked together a lot. And Sam Pittman's as good as there is as an O-line guy. But I really like the Jim Chaney hire, considering how many different people were potentially in the mix for that job. I thought that was a really good hire by Jeremy Pruitt.
Okay. I'll keep an open mind about it. I wasn't at the time. I was a little puzzled why, they were moving heaven and earth to hire him other than to say, hey, we stole him away from our division rival. But you made a pretty compelling case there. All right, Mark Weaver. Hi, Stu and Bruce. Most Power 5 leagues have a school that's consistently toward the bottom of the standings. If you are an up-and-coming coach who wanted to take a shot at the Power 5, rank the following schools in terms of the potential for success. Disregard the current coaches. Kansas, Rutgers, Indiana, Oregon State, and Vanderbilt. You can define success by saying that you would compete for it, but maybe not win the conference championship. So basically, if you were looking for your first Power 5 head coaching job, Which of these seemingly unappealing jobs would actually make the most sense? I'm going to say Kansas, because a lot of these, you know, when you're looking at Indiana, they've just never really been able to do it. Certainly, it's been a long time for Rutgers. Oregon State had some success with Mike Riley.
So are you saying this is the, are you doing this bottom to top or top to bottom?
Top to bottom. I'm saying which one would I take? Like, you know, basically the, like I guess I'm saying is Kansas, is as bad as Kansas is right now, it is mostly a self-inflicted bad hire problem.
Oh, I'm definitely going to disagree with you on this. Go ahead. Keep going.
I don't think that there's institutional, as many institutional hurdles as there are, certainly at, when you're Vanderbilt, the small private school in the SEC, or Oregon State out in the boonies of Corvallis and playing a distant competitor to the Ducks in terms of resources. You know, Kansas football has not had as much success as Kansas basketball, but it was the, you know, in 2007, they were the number two team in the country at one point. Glenn Mason had some success there. Like it can be done. I think the predicament they're in right now is a Charlie Weiss thing that is just taking years for them to dig out of.
First of all, I'm going to take issue with the boonies comment for Corvallis. It's not that far from Eugene, and
That's true. It's not that. I mean, it's a reasonable drive from Portland,
and it's a cool little town. We did a game there. It's definitely got some charm to it. And let's be honest, a lot of colleges are not in the biggest of cities or biggest of markets, so I don't think that's a thing that's going to stick. I'm going to disagree with Kansas for a couple of reasons. Look, I think what Mark Mangino did there to win the way he did was pretty remarkable. Their structure right now is not ideal because you have three non-conference games. Vanderbilt, you get four, which I think is certainly, you know, you have a chance for another cupcake game to get you a bump. I don't think I would put Kansas at the bottom of this list, to be honest.
You would rather have the Rutgers job than the Kansas job.
I would have Indiana actually at the top of this list, but it's in a rough division, as is Rutgers. At least Rutgers is around a bunch of players, though. I mean, Rutgers' recruiting base is actually pretty good. So that part, it's going for it. You know, if you were to tell me that Greg Schiano was going to be the next coach at Rutgers, I think he would have them in a bowl within 3 years.
Well, he's the one guy that's been able to do it. That was a very unique fit that obviously had some success. But since they've been in the Big Ten, I mean, it's just, and same with Indiana, you're just kind of beating your brain in, because what's your ceiling when you're in the same division with Ohio State, Michigan, Michigan State, Penn State?
You know, again, I'm a little biased on Indiana on this because I saw them last year against Ohio State, at Ohio State. They're not bad. I mean, they've been in bowl games. You know, I think Tom Allen does a really good job. They play hard. They're not bad. I mean, again,
no, they're not horrible by any means. They're in contention. They've gotten to a point where they're now in contention to be 6-6 most years. But let me play a guessing game with you here. When's the last time, do you think, what was the last season that Indiana won more than 7 games?
I would guess it's probably been 15 years.
Try 26. So the last time they won 8 games in a season was 1993. And then the last time they did it before that was 1988. So your best case, like, I don't doubt if you were an up-and-coming coach and you're a good coach, you could get them to bowl games, but you're going to get them to very, very low-tier bowl games, and that's probably about it. That's probably the ceiling.
Yeah, but I don't think you're that far away. You're basically a fringe bowl team now. Kansas is light years away from that.
Sure.
I mean, to me, they're the farthest. Like, look, Oregon State, I don't know what, you know, they're a bit of ways, and they're in a tough division. But they have one of the best players in the Pac-12 right now in Jamar Jefferson. I think we've seen Jonathan Smith was a quarterback on a really good team they had that beat Notre Dame in a bowl game. The Fiesta Bowl? I mean, they've been good at times.
So the job you would most want is Indiana, and the job you would least want is Kansas?
The job I would least want is Kansas. I think, let's put it this way. If I was advising a young coach and these are his options, I would say Kansas is the job that would be the biggest uphill climb.
Yeah, it's hard to separate. I guess I've been thinking mostly in terms of just Like he said, don't think about the current coach. So I guess I was saying, don't think about the current situation. Like I wasn't thinking about it as literally you'd be taking over tomorrow. Just more
like to me,
the
you know,
program
James
itself
Franklin,
and the sea
James
and the
Franklin
potential.
Had Vandy as a top 25 team. That wasn't that long ago. You can sell. It's not the same as being in, let's say, Atlanta. But there's a decent amount of talent around Nashville. You know, there's a population boom. There's a lot to, a lot to recruit to. Those the other schools, Kansas to me is like, I don't know how I would necessarily rank the other four, but Kansas to me is a clear five just because they are so far away. And maybe, you know, a lot of that is Charlie Weiss, but some of that isn't. I mean, it's just the way the Big 12 is structured now. When Mark Mangino in Kansas got it going a little bit, the Big 12 was structured differently than it is now.
Can I just say I don't want any of them? No. None of the above?
You know, again, I think some of these other schools you can get to – you're not that far off from getting to 7 or 8 wins. I think you're not far off from getting to 7 wins. And if you get 7 wins at one of these places, you can get a bigger job out of there.
Fair
I
enough.
Just don't think at Kansas you can do that.
I disagree. I think you could be the next Mark Mangino.
Stu, this question is from Quinn in Bowling Green, Ohio. Stu and Bruce, as it stands on July 4th at 10:30 p.m., Ohio State has locked down 13 commitments since May 31st for its 2021 and 2020 classes. Given how Ryan Day is continuing and even building on the success Ohio State already had in recruiting, how do you think his career will start off compared to similar coaching hires at other major programs, most similar to Tom Herman at Texas? Bad year followed by a New Year's Six appearance. Kirby Smart at Georgia, 8-5, followed by an SEC title and national championship game appearance. Or Lincoln Riley, 24-4, 2 Big Ten, Big 12 titles, 2 Heisman QBs, 2 playoff berths. Good question, Quinn.
Good question. I mean, I think I don't think he's necessarily apples to apples with any of those guys. I know that obviously Ohio State fans are hoping that he will be their Lincoln Riley, the guy who takes over for the hugely successful predecessor and immediately is right in playoff contention. And maybe that will happen. I think one big difference, though, Lincoln Riley had the good fortune of taking over. His first team had Baker Mayfield going into his fourth college season. Ryan Day has Justin Fields, who has the buzz of being a future Baker Mayfield, but at this point has no experience to show for that. I'm not surprised, by the way, that he's off to the big start in recruiting. I think anytime, you know, it's my whatever, 2 decades doing this, like the thing you can most easily predict is that when a new coach takes over a blue blood program, his first full recruiting class will be massive. It's just, you're already at a place that recruits well. There's all this excitement about the new coach. There's new energy. There's new buzz. They always do really well. But in terms of on the field this season, it's tough. I just think, basically, if he can turn Justin Fields, not into Dwayne Haskins necessarily, but into an elite quarterback in his first full season, then I think they could win the Big Ten, play in the playoff, contend for a national title. If he struggles, though, they don't have a plan B. Their plan B transferred, so it's a lot riding on the quarterback.
I'm going to say, by the way, it's not just apples to apples. When throwing Tom Herman in there, I think it's like apples to sawdust. The other guys took over relatively similar situations. Tom Herman was taking over a team that had been really down for a while. So,
and even Kirby Smart was not taking over a program that had reached the, you know, that in recent years was anywhere near the level Ohio State is right now.
No, but at least it was a different level than where Texas was. I mean, they were a top 15 team consistently. They weren't a top 5 team. But
if his first year is 8-5 or 7-6, there's going to be a mass freakout because there's no reason Ohio State should be only winning 8 or 7 games.
By the way, I think this is just a read from a couple of audibles we've had. I think you are more skeptical of Justin Fields' talent than you should be.
I'm not skeptical of his talent. I know he's an extremely talented player. I just haven't seen him as a passer yet.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm more influenced by what I've seen in person of him, and from the people I've talked to about him, like, not all 5-star transfers are created equally. I don't think, like, I feel like the tone you have is kind of how I feel more on Jacob Eason. It's not how I feel on this Georgia transfer.
So what kind of season do you think he'll have?
I think Ohio State will be a top six team. I think Justin Field will have a huge season. Statistically, I don't think he'll do what Dwayne Haskins did, because that was outrageous, 50 touchdowns. But he's a much, much better runner, and I think he's going to have a huge year. I think it would not shock me if he got invited to New York for the Heisman.
Great. So now it's the second straight year on this podcast where I'm the Ohio State skeptic and will feel the wrath of Ohio State fans for not believing in them, for completely different reasons than after Urban Meyer's suspension. But you may be right, my friend. You may be right. I watched their spring game, and Justin Fields...
This is one thing we got to keep an eye on. The words like, I watched their spring game, ... is probably one of the more dubious things that we can get sucked down a rabbit hole on.
Yeah, you think they have no relevance whatsoever.
I think they have little relevance.
Yeah.
I think they have little relevance. I don't put as much stock in it as you do. Look, I love watching those spring games for as much for the chatter that you hear from the people who've been around those teams for 2 or 3 days, so you kind of hear more about it. But, I guess I take them a little more of a grain of salt, maybe.
Yeah, look, he made one ridiculous throw in that spring game, and then there were other times when he seemed really uncertain or uncomfortable, which is not that surprising. And I think maybe Trevor Lawrence and Jake Fromm, to some extent, have created this unrealistic... Well, Jalen Hurts, too. Like, these guys were true freshmen who came in and just seemed to know what they were doing right from the beginning. Most quarterbacks take some time to learn the playbook and become more comfortable. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the limited experience he had at Georgia, he did play, he just didn't pass very often, will help him, or if he's basically starting from scratch, new system, new team, being the starting quarterback for the first time. So this next question. Jesse Temple wrote a really good story. He's our Wisconsin writer, wrote a really good Jonathan Taylor feature. And it included a stat that is pretty staggering. Andrew Deer, hi guys, hypothetical that could happen this year. Would Jonathan Taylor be the favorite to win the Heisman if he reaches 2,235 rushing, and passes Donnell Pumphrey as the all-time leading rusher in FBS history in only his true junior season? So he's entering his junior year. If he rushes for 2,235 yards, which is a lot, but he did run for 2,194 this past year, he would break the all-time rushing record in 3 years. What do you think? Make him the favorite to win the Heisman?
Not necessarily. I think he is. There's other quarterbacks who are gonna. I think have higher ceilings on this. We've seen Wisconsin running backs put up huge numbers. Donnell Pumphrey didn't get close to a Heisman. I get it. He was not in a Power 5 league. But, there's going to be a ton of buzz around Tua, and he's still got all those great receivers. There's going to be a lot of buzz around Trevor Lawrence, and his receivers are even better this year than they were last year. Quarterbacks are the focal point. I think Jonathan Taylor would need those guys and whoever else, whether it's Justin Herbert or somebody else, to not shine a level like I think we've seen, especially like the last couple of years with these Oklahoma quarterbacks. I think it's going to be harder and harder, I think, for a running back to win the Heisman with the quarterback numbers that we're seeing with these RPO offenses and all the stuff that's going on.
If Jonathan Taylor breaks the all-time rushing record in 3 seasons and doesn't win the Heisman, then no running back, running back that plays for a team other than Alabama is ever going to win the Heisman again. Because that would be insane. And I get it. Yes, all the focus is on the quarterbacks now. But that would be... And also, we should note, the Heisman, he will not have played his bowl game yet. So he'd have to do this in 12, possibly 13 games. That's a tall order. But I do think it will depend...
Did Christian McCaffrey win the Heisman with that year he had?
No, he didn't. Which, but Derrick Henry did. So it wasn't that he lost out to a quarterback. It was the one exception to the rule lately has been to be the star running back for Alabama. I think it'll be, that's part of it, but it's more, Wisconsin went 8-5 last year. He never sniffed the Heisman, even though he ran for 2,000 yards. If that's the case again, he's a really good player for a really mediocre team. He might not even make it to New York. It's just, people will he'll be out of sight, out of mind. But if it's Jonathan Taylor runs for 2,200 yards and Wisconsin plays in the Big Ten championship game with a shot to go in the playoff, you know, he would be on the very, very, very short list of guys that could win it.
I think it would also help his cause if he cut, you know, he cut down on the fumbles from, I think, 8 to 4. He needs to cut down more than that. I mean, the game we did, he had some fumble issues, and, you know, I think there was...
When you carry the ball every single play of every single game, you're going to fumble occasionally.
You got to cut it down.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, I think you need to have, in this day and age, you need to have the almost the perfect set of circumstances to win a Heisman if you're going to be a running back. I just think it's just a much different game right now, and it's perceived as a much different game. You know, like, I mean, everything is not through the lens of, like, who was the first great running back you remember?
Herschel Walker.
Okay. I mean, that's, you know, whatever, 35 years ago. It's just so much different now than what we've seen. If you look, do you know, so the year Derrick Henry won it, Christian McCaffrey was second. The guy who was third was Deshaun Watson. And I believe, and if I'm not mistaken, maybe that was the year we kind of dinged him for the interceptions.
No, that was the next year.
Right. But that was kind of Deshaun Watson coming out of a little bit of nowhere, right? Because he'd been the guy, and then at the end of the year, he obviously got it cranked up, but I just didn't feel like it was the same thing. And then there was Baker Mayfield's first, you know, big year at Oklahoma.
There's no question it's a completely different sport. I know you've been reading, Matt Brown and Michael Weinrib have been doing every week they look back at a decade as part of the, you know, 150th anniversary. And the 80s was last week. And his running backs for that 80s team were Herschel Walker and Barry Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to argue with that, two of the greatest running backs of all time. However, that means that Bo Jackson did not make the list. Marcus Allen did not make the list. And then who was the quarterback? Doug Flutie. So when he first sent us a draft of this, I said, wait a minute, Doug Flutie was really the best quarterback that played in the 80s? You know, I was waiting for some guy who went on to a dominant NFL career. Nope. There's nobody that really fit that bill. So,
you know, Doug Flutie was a phenomenon in college too. So
it has. I just feel like it's reversed itself. When we get to the end of this decade, there will be all these. You know, we've talked about it a lot lately. All these great quarterbacks from this decade, and only one of them will be on the team. And then I don't know that people will be looking at all the running backs that got left out. You know, it'll be there just haven't been that many true superstar running backs this decade.
Stu and Bruce, what college football 30 for 30s would you most like to see made? Particular ones that may be lesser known but interesting nonetheless. Some that come to mind, and he's got some interesting ones here. Tennessee's 2017 coaching hire debacle. Mike Leach, Craig James fiasco. The Vick brothers and their fall from grace and redemption. Thanks, John from Virginia.
I think those would all be fantastic. The Leach, Craig James one... They would have to interview you. They would have to interview. There's no way Craig James is going to sit down for that. So it would be you, Mike Leach. Who else could they get for that?
They could get Lincoln Riley. They could get Dana Holgerson. They can get a lot of
people. I don't think they're going to get anybody from the Craig James camp is what I'm saying.
Probably not. Although if they got his attorney, that would be pretty entertaining because he was quite the character. I am selfishly fascinated by that one. Somewhere in my house, I have probably literally 700 pages from my deposition where I got deposed by all their lawyers, the ESPN lawyers, the Craig James lawyers, the Spaeth Communications lawyers, and then Leach's lawyers.
How long was your deposition?
It was a whole fucking day, man. It sucked. It sucked.
And were they questions that you were able to easily answer, or did you feel like you were like a suspect for a crime?
It's really strange because I'm not suing anybody. Nobody's suing me. And the idea that somebody would hire a lawyer to go through that is just kind of a puzzling thing. But you know, it's such an invasive, like for anybody who saw like that movie, The Social Network with Jesse Eisenberg, it definitely felt like parts of that. Now, obviously I wasn't, you know, like he's in the middle of it. I was, you know, in part of that, but like at one point, so they had, they being ESPN, I had an ESPN computer for a long time, an ESPN email account. So they pretty much whatever I had, you know, there was no need for discovery. But at one point, one of the attorneys, I want to say it might have been the ESPN, I had a couple of attorneys, said, "What does, you know, such and such mean?" And I like answered it, and I was like, "That is such an odd question." Then I thought about it, and I was like, "Oh my God, these guys are idiots." And I said, "Do you know who?" And I mentioned this name. It was a guy named, his first name was Genesis. And I said, "Do you know who that is?" And they were like, "No." I said, "Do you know what he has to do with this?" And they said, "No." I said, "Nothing. I write in email." And so this was like, I took notes because I talked to some Mountain West or probably WAC coach at the time. You know, this email was found, and it was some junior college safety out here. And it happened to be on like the same kind of like block of text they had. And it was just so weird. And, you know, I don't know. That story, I think, would make, not mine, that story would make a fascinating 30 for 30, just because it was such a screwy case. And I'm sure Leach on camera talking about it in retrospect would be wildly entertaining.
I would like to see a 30 for 30 on any number of conference realignment related things, but the one that I guess I would most want to see is the rise and eventual death of the Pac-16.
Would you like to see one on the Chip Brown, Joe Shad duel off?
Well, that would be a big part of it, I assume. They would both have to sit down for interviews for that.
Yeah, there's a lot of come to mind now that I'm thinking. Like, I was like, you know, just kind of some of these stories that get, you know, like I'm ESPN did a really good 30 for 30 on like the day of the, I want to say it was like, I forgot what date in history it was in 1994 where a bunch of stuff happened. The day of Wonstadt's team knocks West Virginia out of the title game, and like five other crazy upsets happened that day, right?
Yeah,
you remember that?
Like, well, sure. I mean, you could do a 30 for 30 on the whole 2007 season.
Yeah, I think that would be an interesting one. Yeah, there's a lot of them. I should have given this question, you know, much more thought on it. But
all right, last but not least, everybody wants to know. So I would say we got probably in the neighborhood of 40 emails of people trying to guess our ages. And I think, you know, I said, don't Google it. And I think people stuck to that because most of them were, I don't think there were many that were wildly off. But since I picked the questions, I got to include one of the only like ridiculous outliers. And that would be Kevin Sabir of Rockwell, Texas, Bruce, thinks you're 58.
Kevin Sabir doesn't think I'm 58. If he does, he doesn't know what 58 looks like. By the way, Kevin Sabir, I feel like I have interacted with on social media.
Well,
on Twitter at some
he
point.
He thinks you're 58. So, you know, sorry. I guess plastic surgery isn't really helping the way you thought it would.
Plastic surgery? If I had plastic, look, I didn't even dye my hair. Why would I plastic surgery?
Once we give the big reveal here, nobody, I don't think anybody that met you in person would guess that was your age. So anyway, so here are the finalists, okay? We've got, I included, what, three of these? Kenny Wittenberg, who, I don't know if this is a compliment or an insult, who says, I listen to six different college football podcasts, not to be mean, but you guys are number five in the queue behind podcast Ain't Played Nobody, Solid Verbal, 24/7, and Athlon. At least you're ahead of Shutdown Fullcast. Well, thanks, Kenny, I guess. He guessed that you're 50 and I'm 44. Is he correct?
Is he correct? I think he's correct.
He is almost correct. How about Alan from Tulsa, Oklahoma, who's guessing that I am 42 and Bruce is 50? Almost.
I think he's correct. I don't
almost.
Think he's correct.
Steve from Rocky River, Ohio, guesses that you are 51 and I'm 42.
No, I think he's wrong.
He's wrong. Nobody got it exactly right, so nobody's going to get the swag. But I'm 43 and Bruce is 50.
Okay. By the way, do you remember we were in Columbus, Ohio, and this story is not even worth telling. I was going to say where somebody thought you were older than Teddy Greenstein. It was like Pete Thamel's cousin. We were out to at like a forgot what the name. It wasn't a Chuck.
That was a long time ago. That cousin was like a teenager then and is now full on adult.
Wasn't it Chuck E. Cheese? What was the place where like it was like a?
I think it was a Dave and Buster's, right?
Dave and Buster's, thank you. Chuck E. Cheese.
So long ago. That may have been before the famous number one versus number two game in 06.
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
Because usually I stay closer to Ohio State, but I don't think.
So are you saying you've aged better than Teddy now from that time?
Teddy's got more gray than I do, but the point is he's only 4 years older than me, so it's not like. I mean, maybe, I don't know, it doesn't seem like that would be a huge mix-up. If somebody said that I was older than you, I think I would take exception to that.
I don't know.
You're definitely in better shape, but I don't know. I don't think you look 50, but I hope you don't, that the consensus isn't that if you stand the two of us together, I look like the older one.
No, I have much more, also I'm out in the sun more, but I have way more lines in my face, for sure.
Yeah, when you're on TV and they apply all that makeup and product... then, you know, no doubt you look younger.
You know where I notice it? God, why are we talking about this? Whenever I did that oral history on the Texas Tech OU game, so I found, you know, the interview after the game, I'm interviewing Baker Mayfield on camera. I'm like, man, I aged quite a bit in just 2 years.
Kids. So.
That's right. Those are the culprits. That is exactly right.
Aged more in the last 3 years than in any of the previous 40. There's no question.
That's true. That's what happens. They drag the life out of you sometimes.
Just last night, the night before recording this, my daughter, my usually well-behaved darling daughter, had a temper tantrum that lasted a good 25, 30 minutes straight and involved a lot of high-pitched screaming right in my ear. So... I may have aged 3 years just last night.
Yeah, well, now that she's learning the profanity, it's all downhill.
Yep, it's all downhill from here. All right, well, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Next week is conference media days. Hard to believe it. We'll have some, I don't know if we'll have big news, but we'll have some news and some developments to talk about. We'll see you then.
If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to The Audible on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review while you're at it. It helps get the word out. Thanks to Trader Joe's for being our presenting sponsor. Our producer is Nick Fink. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octave. You can download their music on iTunes and Spotify. Follow me, Stu, at SL Mandel on Twitter and Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB, and subscribe to The Athletic if you haven't done so already. You can try it for free, 7-day free trial at theathletic.com/free trial. So come on, get over here. Ah, yeah. Whoa, whoa, whoa. We'll talk about